Chapter 18 of The Black Moth. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tara Mendoza. The Black Moth by Georgette Hare. Chapter 18. Enter Captain Harold Lovelace. At the end of August, after having spent a moderately quiet summer in the country, Lady Lavinia was again seized with a longing for town and its attractions. She would not listen to Richard's warnings of the atrocious condition of the roads, declaring that she cared not one jot, and go to London she must. After that one protest, he desisted and promised to take her there the following week, secretly counting himself lucky to have kept her so long at Wyncham in comparative cheerfulness of spirits. Lavinia was overjoyed, kissed him again and again, scolded herself for being such a wicked tease, and set about making her preparations for the journey. The roads proved even worse than Richard had prophesied, and twice the coach nearly upset, and times without number stuck fast in the mire, causing the inmates much inconvenience. Carstairs rode by the side of the heavy vehicle, in which were his wife, her maid, her tiny dog, and countless bandboxes and small parcels. In spite of the worry the constant stoppages entailed, he quite enjoyed the journey, for Lavinia was in excellent spirits, and made light of their mishaps, receiving each fresh one with roguish laughter and some witty remark. Even when the chimney of her bedchamber, at one of the inns at which they halted, smoked most vilely, she did not, as Richard quite expected she would, fly into a rage and refuse to spend another moment in the house, but, after looking extremely doleful, cheered up and told dear Dicky that she would have his room while he should have hers. Then in the morning she would find him all dried up and smoked. In high good humour she went down to dinner with him, voted the partridges excellent, the pasties quite French, and the wine marvellously tolerable for such an out-of-the-way place, and kept him laughing at her antics until bedtime. The journey was of necessity very slow, not only on account of the bad roads, but because whenever Milady caught sight of wild roses growing on the hedges, she must stop to pluck some. Then she and Richard would stroll along for some way, he leading his horse, the coach following at a walking pace, all of which was very idyllic, and had the effect of sending Richard to the seventh heaven of content. When at length they arrived at Wyncham House, Mayfair, they found that the servants had arrived a week before, and had made good use of their time. Never, declared Lavinia, had the house looked so inviting, so spick and span. One of her black pages proffered a small monkey, with much bowing and grinning, and the murmur of, "Massa's present." Lady Lavinia flew to embrace her Dicky. How did he guess that she had for so long yearned for a monkey? Surely she had but once or twice mentioned it. Oh, he was the very best of husbands. She danced off to her apartments in a state of ecstasy. The beau monde was retiring to town, and when a few days later Carstairs conducted his wife to Ranelagh, they found the gardens fairly crowded and very gay. Lamps hung from tree branches, although it was still quite light. The fiddlers scraped away almost without a pause. Fireworks shot up from one end. The summer-houses had all been freshly painted, and the pavilion was a blaze of light. Consciousness of her beauty and the smartness of her Georgia silk gown, with its petticoat covered in gold net, considerably added to Lavinia's enjoyment. Her hair she wore powdered, and elaborately curled down on both sides with dainty escalloped lace half-concealing it, and a grey capuchin over all. Her tippet was gold lace to match her petticoat, and to fasten it she wore a brooch, composed of clustered rubies. Rubies also hung in her earrings, which last were of such length that the other ladies turned to stare in envy, and the bracelets that she wore over her long gloves flashed also with the great red stones. She was well pleased with Richard's appearance, and reflected that, when he chose, he could be very fashionable indeed. The claret-coloured velvet he was wearing was most distinguished, and the gold clocks to his hose quite ravishing. They had not been in the gardens 10 minutes before a little crowd of men had gathered around them, professing themselves in rapture to behold the fair Lady Lavinia once more. One of them fetched her a chair, another a glass of negus, and the rest hovered eagerly about her. Becomingly flushed with triumph, my lady gave her little hand to Mr. Selwyn, who had been once a very ardent admirer, laughed at his neat compliment, and declared that he was a dreadful flattering demon, and positively she would not listen to him. Sir Gregory Markham, who brought her the negus, she discovered to have just returned from Paris. On hearing this, she broke off in the middle of a conversation with an enchanted French chevalier, and turned to him, raising her china blue eyes to his face and clasping tight gloved hands.
"Oh, Sir Gregory! Paris? Then tell me, please tell me, have you seen my darling devil?"
"Why, yes, madame," responded Markham, handing her the glass he held. She sipped the negus and gave it to the chevalier to take care of.
"I declare, I quite love you, then!" she exclaimed. "What is he doing? And, oh, when will he return to England?"
Sir Gregory smiled. "How can I say?" he drawled. "I fear monsieur's amuse." She flirted her fan before her face.
"Dreadful creature!" she cried. "How dare you say such things?"
"Belmanoir?" inquired Lord D'Egmont, twirling his cane. "Enamoured of the pompadour, is he not? Saving your presence, Lady Lavvy." Lavinia let fall her fan.
"The pompadour? He had best have a care."
"I believe there has already been some unpleasantness between His Majesty and the fair Jeanne on the subject of devil. Since then he is supposed to have turned on him a cold shoulder." "I heard 'twas he wearied of madame," said Markham.
"Well, whichever it was, I am glad the episode is closed," decided Lavinia. "'Tis too dangerous a game to play with Louis's mistresses. Oh, mon cher chevalier, if I had not forgot your presence! But I am sure you say dreadful ill-natured things of our George, now don't you? Oh, and have you held my negus all this time? How monstrous good of you! There, I will drink it, and Julian shall take the glass away. Voila!"
She handed it to D'Egmont and rapped Mr. Selwyn's knuckles with her fan, looking archly up at him as he stood behind her chair.
"Naughty man! Will you have done whispering in my ear? I vow I will not listen to your impudences. No, nor laugh at them, neither. Sir Gregory, you have given me no answer. When will Tracy return? For the Cavendish rout on Wednesday week? Ah, say yes!"
"Certainly, I will say yes, fair tormentor. But to tell the truth, Tracy said no word of coming to London when I saw him." She pouted.
"Now I hate you, Sir Gregory. And he has been absent since May. Oh, Julian, back already? You shall escort me to the fireworks, then. Oh, my fan, where is it? I know I dropped it on the ground. Selwyn, if you have taken it— Oh, Dicky, you have it. Thank you. See, I am going with Julian, and you may ogle Mrs. Clive, whom I see walking over there. Yes, positively you may, and I shall not be jealous. Very well, Julian, I am coming. Chevalier, I shall hope to see you at the rout on Wednesday week, but you must wait upon me before then."
The Frenchman brightened.
"Madame is too good. I may call at Windsor House, vraiment. I shall both exist until then."
In a perfectly audible whisper, he confided to Wilding that
"Milady diète ravissante, mais ravissante."
Lady Lavinia went off on her gratified chevalier's arm, encountering many bows and much admiration as she passed down the walk, leaving her husband not to ogle the beautiful Kitty as she had advised, but to saunter away in the direction of the pavilion in company with Tom Wilding and Markham. D'Egmont guided my lady into one of the winding alleys, and they presently came out on a large lawn dotted over with people of all conditions. Towards them was coming Lavinia's brother, Colonel Lord Robert Belmanoir, very richly clad and rakish in appearance. When he saw his sister, a look of surprise came into his florid face, and he made her a sweeping leg.
"'Pon my honour, Lavinia."
My lady was not fond of her brother, and acknowledged the salutation with a brief nod.
"I am delighted to see you, Robert,"
she said primly.
"The mere word delighted in no way expresses my sensations," replied the colonel in the drawling, rather unpleasant voice peculiar both to him and to the duke.
"Your servant, D'Egmont. I imagined, Lavvy, that you were in the country."
"Richard brought me to town last Tuesday," she answered.
"How unwise of him," taunted the colonel. "Or had he no choice?"
She tossed her head angrily.
"If you are minded to be disagreeable, Robert, pray do not let me detain you," she flashed.
D'Egmont was quite unembarrassed by this interchange of civilities. He knew the Belmanoir family too well to be made uncomfortable by their bickerings.
"Shall we leave him?" he asked Lavinia, smiling.
"Yes,"
she pouted.
"He is determined to be unpleasant."
"My dear sister, on the contrary, I believe I can offer you some amusement. Lovelace is in town.
Captain Harold! She cried incredulously.
The same.
Oh, Bob!
Impulsively, she withdrew her hand from Julian's arm, transferring it to the Colonel's.
I must see him at once, to think he has returned after all these years. Quick, Julian, dear lad, go and find him, and tell him 'tis I, Lavinia, who want him. You know him, do you not? Yes, I thought you did. Send him to me at once, at once!
D'Egmont looked crestfallen at having his walk with the goddess thus cut short, but he had perforce to kiss her hand and to obey.
"Yes, I thought you would be pleased," remarked Lord Robert, and chuckled. "Allow me to point out to you that there is a chair—two chairs, in fact, quite a number of chairs—immediately behind you."
She sat down, chattering excitedly.
"Why, 'tis nigh on 5 years since I saw Harry. Has he changed? Lord, but he will deem me an old woman. Is he like to be in town for long, I wonder? Dear me, Bob, look at the two ladies over behind that seat. Gracious, what extraordinary coifs, to be sure, and cherry ribbons, too. Tell me, Bob, where did you meet Harry Lovelace?"
The Colonel, who, far from attending to her monologue, had been sending amorous glances across to a palpably embarrassed girl who hung on her papa's arm while that gentleman stopped to speak to a stout dowager, brought his gaze reluctantly back to his sister.
"What's that you say, Lavvy?"
"How provoking of you not to listen to me! I asked where you met Harold."
"Where I meant him? Let me see. Where did I meet him? Oh, I remember. At the Cocoa Tree a fortnight since."
"And he is altered?"
"Not in any way, my dear sister. He is the same mad, reckless rake-hell as ever, and unmarried."
"How delightful! Oh, I shall be so glad to see him again!"
"You must present him to Richard," sneered the Colonel, "as an old flame."
"I must indeed,"
she agreed, his sarcasm passing over her head.
"Oh, I see him! Look, coming across the grass!"
She rose to meet the tall, fair young guardsman, who came swiftly towards her, curtsying as only Lady Lavinia could curtsy, with such stateliness and coquetry.
"Captain Lovelace!"
She put forward both her hands. Lovelace caught them in his, and bent his head over them so that soft, powdered curls of his loose wig fell all about his face.
"Lady Lavinia! Enchantress! I can find no words. I am dumb."
"And I!"
"In that case," drawled the Colonel, "you are not like to be very entertaining company. Pray give me leave."
He bowed and sauntered away down the path, with a peculiarly malicious smile on his lips. Lavinia and Lovelace found two chairs slightly apart from the rest, and sat down, talking eagerly.
"Captain Lovelace, I believe you had forgot me,"
she rallied him.
"Never," he answered promptly. "Not though you well nigh broke my heart."
"No, no, I did not do that. I never meant to hurt you."
He shook his head disbelievingly.
"You rejected me to marry some other man. Do you say you did not mean to?"
"You naughty Harry! You never married yourself."
"I?"
The delicate features expressed a species of hurt horror.
"I marry? No. I was ever faithful to my first love."
She unfurled her fan, fluttering it delightedly.
"Oh, oh, always, Harold. Now speak the truth."
"Nearly always," he amended.
"Disagreeable man! You admit you had lapses, then?"
"So very trivial, my dear," he excused himself. "And I swear, my first action on coming to London was to call at Wyncham House. Imagine my disappointment, my incalculable gloom on the top of having already dropped 1,000 at Pharaoh, when I found the shell void, and Venus—"
She stopped him, her fan held ready for chastisement.
"Sir, you said your first action was to call upon me."
He smiled, shaking back his curls.
"I should have said, my first action of any importance."
"You do not deem losing 1,000 guineas important?"
she asked wistfully.
"Well, hardly. One must enjoy life. And what's 1,000, after all? I had my pleasure out of it."
"Yes,"
she breathed, her eyes sparkling.
"That is how I think. What pleasure can one get if one neither hazards nor spends one's money? Oh, well,"
she shrugged one shoulder, dismissing the subject.
"Have you seen Tracy of late?"
"He was at a court ball I attended at Versailles, but I did not have a chance of speaking with him. I heard he was very popular at Paris.
Aye, she said proudly. He has the French air. I so desire to see him again, but I fear he does not think of returning. I know he was promised for the Duchess of Devonshire's rout months ago, before even the date was fixed. She so dotes on him. But I do not expect to see him there. She sighed, and drummed on the ground with her diamond-buckled shoe. Harry, I am chilled. Take me to the pavilion. I doubt they are dancing, and Dicky will be there.
Dicky, he repeated. Dicky, Lavinia? Do not tell me there is another claimant to your heart.
Wicked and delicate creature! 'Tis my husband.
Your husband? En fin. She cast him a sidelong glance of mingled coquetry and reproof.
Your mind is at rest again, I trust.
Of course. A husband. Pooh! A bagatelle, no more.
My husband is not a bagatelle, she laughed. I am very fond of him.
This grows serious, he frowned. 'Tis very unfashionable, surely.
She met his teasing eyes and cast down her lashes.
Captain Lovelace, you may take me to the pavilion.
Sweet tormentor, not until you cease to misname me so.
Harold, I am indeed chilly,
she said plaintively, and snatched her hand from his lips.
No, no, people will stare. Look, there is my odious brother returning. I declare I will not stay to listen to his hateful, sneering remarks. Come.
They walked across the grass together, keeping up a running fire of raillery, punctuated on his side by extravagant compliments filled with classical allusions, all more or less erroneous, and on hers by delighted little laughs and mock scoldings. So they came to the pavilion, where the musicians fiddled for those who wished to dance, and where most of the company had assembled now that it was growing chilly without. Down one end of the hall, card tables were set out, where members of both sexes diced and gambled, drinking glasses of burgundy or negus, the men toasting the ladies, and very often the ladies returning the toasts with much archness and low curtsying. Lavinia cast off her capuchin and plumed her feathers, giving a surreptitious shake to her rouged skirts and smoothing her ruffles. She rustled forward with great stateliness, fan unfurled, head held high, her gloved fingers resting lightly on Lovelace's velvet clad arm. Richard, hearing the little stir caused by her entry, glanced up and perceived her. He did not recognize her companion, but the sparkle in her eyes and the happy curve to her full lips were quite enough to tell him that it was someone whom she was very contented to have met. He had ample opportunity for studying Lovelace as the good-looking pair drew near, and he could not but admire the delicate, handsome face with the grey eyes that held a laugh in them, the pleasure-loving, well-curved mouth, and the chin that spoke of determination. Here was not one of Lavinia's lisping, painted puppy-dogs, for in spite of the effeminate curls, it was easy to see that this man had character and a will of his own, and above all a great charm of manner. He saw Lavinia blush and rap the captain's knuckles in answer to some remark, and his heart sank. He rose and came to meet them. Lady Lavinia smiled sweetly upon him, and patted his arm with a possessive little air.
"Dicky, dear, I have found an old friend, a very old friend. Is it not agreeable? Captain Lovelace? Mr. Carstairs?"
The two men bowed, Richard with reluctancy, the captain with easy bonhomie.
"Sir, I claim to be a worshipper at the shrine of which you, I believe, are high priest," he said impudently, and bowed again, this time to milady. "You are one of many, sir," smiled Richard.
Lady Devereux came tripping up to them and kissed Lavinia with a great show of affection.
"My dearest life, my sweet Lavinia!"
Lady Lavinia presented a powdered cheek.
"Dearest Fanny, how charming to see you again," she cooed.
Through her lashes, she gazed at her friend's enormous headdress with its rolls of powdered curls and the imitation flowers perched upon the top of the erection.
"But my angel!"
exclaimed Lady Fanny, stepping back to view her.
"Surely you have been ill!" "How strange!" smiled Lavinia. "I was about to ask you that same question, my dear. 'Tis age, I doubt not. Do we both look such dreadful hags?"
She turned her bewitching little countenance to the men and smiled appealingly. Compliments showered upon her and Lady Devereux, who was conscious that her own sallow countenance, in spite of rouge and powder, must appear even more sallow beside Lavinia's pink and whiteness, flushed in annoyance and turned away, begging her dearest Lavvy to come to the Faro with her. But Lavinia, it appeared, was going to watch the dicing at Richard's table. She vowed she should bring him monstrous good luck.
"I don't doubt it, my dear,"
replied her husband. "But I am not playing to-night. Will you not take your luck to Bob?" He nodded to where the Colonel was lounging, dice-box in hand. Lavinia pouted.
"No, I want you to play."
"'Tis of no avail, Lady Lavinia," drawled Sir Gregory. "Richard is the very devil to-night."
Selwyn, rattling his dice, paused and looked round at Markham with a face of innocent surprise. Then he turned slowly and stared at Carstairs' grave, almost stern countenance, with even more surprise. He started to rattle the dice again, and shifted back to face his opponent with pursed lips.
"Is he?"
he inquired with studied depression. Even Lavinia joined in the general laugh, not so much at the wit's words as at the comic expression, and the extreme deliberation with which he had enacted the little scene. Someone cried a bet to Lovelace, which was promptly accepted, and Lavinia's eyes glowed afresh as she followed the captain to a table. Richard went to fetch her some refreshment, and on his return found her leaning over Lovelace's chair, her hand on his shoulder, eagerly casting the dice onto the table. He was in time to see her clasp her hands and to hear her cry of,
"My luck! Oh, my luck is in! I will throw again!"
Glancing round, she caught sight of her husband, and her face fell.
"Do you mind, Dickie?"
she pleaded. He did mind, but he could not appear churlish before all these men, so he laughed and shook his head and went to her elbow to watch her play. When she at length ceased, her luck had run out, and she had lost her much-prized ruby earring to Mr. Selwyn, who placed it carefully in his vest pocket, vowing he should wear it next to his heart forever. Then, and then only, did she consent to leave the gaming tables for the dancing hall, and for another hour Richard had the felicity of watching her tread the minuet with various young bloods, but most often with her new-found Harry Lovelace. End of Chapter 18. Recording by Tara Mendoza, Phoenix, Arizona, September 2011. Chapter 19 of The Black Moth. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tara Mendoza. The Black Moth by Georgette Hare. Chapter 19. The Reappearance of His Grace of Andover. It seemed to Richard, in the days that followed, that Captain Lovelace was never out of his house. If he went to his wife's boudoir, there was Lovelace, hanging over her while she played upon the spinet, or glanced through the pages of the Rambler. If Lavinia went to a ball or masquerade, the captain was always amongst the favoured ones, admitted to her chamber for the express purpose of watching her don her gown and judiciously place her patches. If Carstairs begged his wife's company one morning, she was full of regrets. Harry was calling to take her to Vauxhall, or to Spring Gardens. When he entered his room, the first sight that met his eyes was the captain's amber-clouded cane and pointed-edged hat. And, when he looked out of the window, it was more often to see a chair draw up at the house and Lovelace alight. After patiently enduring a week of his continued presence, Carstairs remonstrated with his wife. She must not encourage her friend to spend all his time at Grosvenor Square. At first she had looked reproachful, and then she inquired his reason. His reluctant answer was that it was not seemly. At that her eyes opened wide, and she demanded to know what could be more seemly than the visits of such an old friend. With a gleam of humour, Richard replied that it was not Captain Harold's age that he objected to, but on the contrary, his youth, on which she accused him of being jealous. It was true enough, but he indignantly repudiated the suggestion. Very well, then, he was merely stupid. He must not be cross. Harry was her very good friend, and did not Richard admire the new device for her hair? Richard was not to be cajoled. Did she clearly understand that Lovelace's visits must cease? She only understood one thing, and that was that Dicky was marvellous, ill-tempered, and ridiculous today, and he must not tease her. Yes, she would be very good, but so must he, and now she was going shopping, and she would require at least 20 guineas. In spite of her promise to be good, she made no attempt to discourage Lovelace's attentions, always smiling charmingly upon him, and beckoning him to her side. It was the morning of the Duchess of Devonshire's rout that Carstairs again broached the subject. My lady was in bed, her fair hair unpowdered and streaming all about her shoulders, her chocolate on a small table at her side, and countless billet-doux from admirers scattered on the sheet. In her hand she held a bouquet of white roses with a card attached, bearing in bold, sprawling characters the initials H.L. Perhaps it was the sight of those incriminating letters that roused Richard's anger. At all events, with a violence quite unlike his usual gentle politeness, he snatched the flowers from her hand and sent them whizzing into a corner.
"Let there be an end to all this folly," he cried.
Lavinia raised herself on one elbow, astonished.
How dare you?" she gasped.
"It has come to that," he answered. "How dare I, your husband, try to control your actions in any way? I tell you, Lavinia, I have had enough of your antics, and I will no longer put up with them."
You, what in heaven's name ails you, Richard?"
"This. I will not countenance that puppy's invasion of my house."
He made a furious gesture towards the wilted bouquet. "Neither will I permit you to make yourself the talk of London through him."
I make myself the talk of London? How dare you? Oh, how dare you?"
"I beg you will cease that foolishness. There is no question of my daring. How dare you disobey me, as you have been doing all this past week?"
She cowered away from him.
"Dicky!"
"'Tis very well to cry, Dicky, and to smile, but I have experienced that before. Sometimes I think you are utterly without heart, a selfish, vain, extravagant woman."
The childish lips trembled. Lady Lavinia buried her face in the pillows, sobbing. Carstairs' face softened.
"I beg your pardon, my dear. Mayhap that was unjust."
"And cruel, and cruel."
"And cruel. Forgive me."
She twined white, satiny arms about his neck.
"You did not mean it."
"No. I mean that I will not allow Lovelace to dangle after you, however."
She flung away from him.
"You have no right to speak like that. I knew Harry long before I ever set eyes on you."
He winced.
"You infer that he is more to you than I am."
"No, though you try to make me hate you. No, I love you best, but I will not send Harry away."
"Not if I order it?"
"Order it? Order it? No, no, a thousand times no."
"I do order it."
"I refuse to listen to you."
"By God, madam, you need a lesson," he flamed. "I am minded to take you back to Wyncham this very day, and I promise you that an you do not obey me in this, to Wyncham you shall go."
He stamped out of the room as he spoke, and she sank back amongst her pillows, white and trembling with fury. As soon as she was dressed, she flounced downstairs, bent on finishing the quarrel. But Carstairs had gone out some time since, and was not expected to return until late. For a moment Lavinia was furious, but the timely arrival of a box from her mantua makers chased away the frowns and wreathed her face in smiles. Richard did not return until it was time to prepare for the rout, and on entering the house he went straight to his chamber, putting himself into the hands of his valet. He submitted to the delicate tinting of his fingernails, the sprinkling of his linen with rose water, and the stenciling of his brows. He was arrayed in puce and gold, rings slipped onto his fingers, his legs coaxed into hose with marvellous clocks splashed on their sides, and a diamond buckle placed above the large black bow of his tie-wig. Then powdered, painted, and patched, he went slowly across to his wife's room. Lavinia, who had by now quite forgotten the morning's contretemps, greeted him with a smile. She sat before the mirror in her undergown with a loose déchabille thrown over her shoulders. The coiffure had departed, and her hair, thickly powdered, was dressed high above her head, over cushions, twisted into curls over her ears, and allowed to fall in more curls over her shoulders. On top of the creation were poised ostrich feathers, scarlet and white, and round her throat gleamed a great necklace of diamonds. The room was redolent of some heavy perfume. Discarded ribbons, laces, slippers, and gloves strode the floor. Over the back of a chair hung a brilliant scarlet domino, and tenderly laid out on the bed was her gown, a mass of white satin and brocade, with full ruffles over the hips and quantities of foaming lace falling from the corsage and from the short sleeves. Beside it reposed her fan, her soft lace gloves, her mask, and her tiny reticule. Carstairs gingerly sat down on the extreme edge of a chair and watched the maid tint his wife's already perfect cheeks.
"I shall break hearts tonight, shall I not?"
she asked gaily over her shoulder.
"I do not doubt it," he answered shortly.
"And you, Dickie?"
She turned around to look at him.
"Puce! 'Tis not the colour I should have chosen, but 'tis well enough. A new wig, Shelley?"
"Ay."
Her eyes questioned his coldness, and she suddenly remembered the events of the morning. So, he was sulky. Very well, monsieur should see. Someone knocked at the door. The maid went to open it.
"Sir Douglas Faversham, Sir Gregory Markham, Miss Soleil Chevere, and Captain Lovelace are below, m'lady."
A little devil prompted Lavinia.
"Ooh la la! So many! Well, I cannot see all, 'tis certain. Admit Sir Gregory and Captain Lovelace."
Louisa communicated this to the lackey and shut the door. Richard bit his lip angrily.
"Are you sure I am not de trop?"
he asked, savagely sarcastic. Lady Lavinia cast aside her déshabille and stood up.
"Oh, 'tis no matter. I am ready for my gown, Louisa."
There came more knocking at the door, and this time it was Carstairs who rose to open it. There entered Markham, heavily handsome in crimson and gold, and Lovelace, his opposite, fair and delicately pretty in palest blue and silver. As usual, he wore his loose wig, and in it sparkled three sapphire pins. He made Milady a marvellous leg.
"I am prostrated by your beauty, fairest."
Sir Gregory was eyeing Lavinia's white slippers through his quizzing-glass.
"Jewelled heels, 'pon my soul," he drawled.
She parried gracefully, her feet flashing as they caught the light.
"Was it not well thought on?" she demanded. "But I must not waste time. The dress. Now, Markham. Now, Harry. You will see the creation."
Lovelace sat down on a chair, straddlewise, his arms over the back, and his chin sunk in his hands. Markham leant against the garter-robe and watched through his glass. When the dress was at last arranged, the suggested improvements in the matter of lace, ribbons, and the adjustment of a brooch thoroughly discussed, bracelets fixed on her arms, and the flaming domino draped about her, it was full three-quarters of an hour later, and Carstairs was becoming impatient. It was not in his nature to join with the two men in making fulsome compliments, and their presence at the toilette filled him with annoyance. He hated that Lavinia should admit them, but it was the mode, and he knew he must bow the head under it. My lady was at last ready to start. Her gilded chair awaited her in the light of the flambeau at the door, and with great difficulty she managed to enter it, taking absurd pains that her silks should not crush, nor the nodding plumes of her huge headdress become disordered by unseemly contact with the roof. Then she found that she had left her fan in her room, and Lovelace and Markham must needs vie with one another in the fetching of it. While they wrangled wittily for the honour, Richard went quietly indoors and presently emerged with the painted chicken skin, just as Lovelace was preparing to ascend the steps. At last Lavinia was shut in, and the bearers picked up the poles. Off went the little cavalcade down the long square, the chair in the middle. Lovelace walked close beside it on the right, and Richard and Markham on the left. So they proceeded through the uneven streets, carefully picking their way through the dirtier parts, passing other chairs and pedestrians, all coming from various quarters into South Audley Street. They were remarkably silent, Markham from habitual laziness, Lovelace because he sensed Richard's antagonism, and Richard himself on account of his extremely worried state of mind. In fact, until they reached Curzon Street, no one spoke, and then it was only Markham who, glancing behind him at the shuttered windows of the great corner-house, casually remarked that Chesterfield was still at Wells. An absent assent came from Carstairs, and the conversation came to an end. In Clarges Street they were joined by Sir John Fortescue, an austere patrician, and although some years his senior, a close friend of Richard's. They fell behind the chair, and Fortescue took Richard's proffered arm.
"I did not see you at White's today, John." "No, I had some business with my lawyer." "I suppose you did not stumble across my poor brother?" "Frank?" "I did not." "But why the poor—" Fortescue shrugged slightly. "I think the lad is demented," he said. "He was to have made one of March's supper-party last night,
but at 4 o'clock received a communication from heaven knows whom, which threw him into a state of unrest. What must he do but hurry off without a word of explanation? Since then I have not set eyes on him, but his man tells me he went to meet a friend. Damned unusual of him is all I have to say. Very strange. Do you expect to see him tonight? I should hope so. My dear Carstairs, who is the man walking by your lady's chair? Markham? The other? Lovelace. Lovelace? And who the devil is he? I cannot tell you, beyond a captain in the guards. That even is news to me. I saw him at Goose Trees the other night and wondered. Somewhat of a rake hell, I surmise. I dare say I do not like him. They were entering the gates of Devonshire House now, and had to part company, for the crush was so great that it was almost impossible to keep together. Carstairs stayed by Lavinia's chair, and the other men melted away into the crowd. Chairs jostled one another in the effort to get to the door. Town coaches rolled up, and having let down their fair burdens, passed out again slowly, pushing through the throng. When the Carstairs chair at last drew near the house, it was quite a quarter of an hour later. The ballroom was already full and a blaze of riotous colour. Lavinia was almost immediately borne off by an infatuated youth, for whom she cherished a motherly affection that would have caused the unfortunate to tear his elegant locks, had he known it. Richard distinguished Lord Andrew Belmanoir, one of a group of bucks gathered about the newest beauty, Miss Gunning, who, with her sister Elizabeth, had taken fashionable London by storm. Andrew wore a mask, but he was quite unmistakable by his length of limb and carelessly rakish appearance. Wilding, across the room, beckoned to Richard, and on his approach dragged him to the card-room to play at lansquenet with March, Selwyn, and himself. Carstairs found the Earl in great good humour, due, so Selwyn remarked, to the finding of an upper singer even more lovely than the last. From lansquenet they very soon passed to dice and betting, with others who strolled up to the table. Then Carstairs excused himself and went back to the ballroom. He presently found himself by the side of one Isabella Fanshawe, a sprightly widow greatly famed for her wittiness and good looks. Carstairs had met her but once before, and was now rather surprised that she motioned him to her side, patting the couch with an inviting, much-beringed hand. "Come and sit by me, Mr. Carstairs. I have wanted to speak with you this long time." She lowered her mask as she spoke, and closely scrutinized his face with her bright, humorous eyes.
"Why, madam, I am flattered," bowed Richard.
She cut him short. "I am not in the mood for compliments, sir, nor am I desirous of making or hearing clever speeches. You are worrying me." Richard sat down, intrigued and attracted by this downright little woman.
"I, madam?"
"You, sir. That is, your face worries me." Seeing his surprise, she laughed, fanning herself. "'Tis comely enough, I grant you. I mean there is such a strong likeness to a friend of mine." Richard smiled politely and relieved her of the fan.
"Indeed, madam."
"Yes, I knew this other gentleman in Vienna 3 years ago. I should judge him younger than you, I think. His eyes were blue, but very similar to yours. His nose was almost identical with yours, but the mouth, no, yet the whole expression." She broke off, noticing her companion's sudden pallor. "But you are unwell, sir."
"No, madam, no. What was your friend's name?"
"Ferndale," she answered. "Anthony Ferndale." The fan stopped its swaying for a moment. "Ah," said Richard. "Do you know him?" she inquired eagerly.
"Many years ago, madam, I was acquainted with him."
"Can you tell me? Was he in good spirits when you last saw him?" She pursed her lips thoughtfully. "If you mean, was he gay? Was he witty? Yes. But sometimes I thought, Mr. Carstairs, when he was silent, his eyes were so sad. Indeed, I do not know why I tell you this."
"You may be sure, madam, your confidence is safe with me. I had a great regard for this gentleman."
He opened and shut her fan as he spoke, fidgeting with the slender sticks.
"You, too, were interested in him, madam?"
"I do not think ever anyone knew him and was not, sir. It was something in his manner, his personality, I cannot explain, that endeared him to one. and he once aided me when I was in difficulties." Richard, remembering scraps of gossip concerning the widow's past, merely bowed his head. She was silent for a time, staring down at her hands, but presently she looked up, smiling, and took her fan away from him. "I cannot abide a fidget, sir," she told him, "and I see Lord Fotheringham approaching. I am promised to him this dance." She rose, but Richard detained her. "Mrs. Fanshawe, will you permit me to call upon you? I would hear more of your friend. You mayhap think it strange, but—"
"No," she answered, "I do not. Certainly call upon me, sir. I lodge in Mount Street with my sister, number 16.
"I protest, madam, you are too good."
"Again, no, I have told you. I like a man to talk as a man, and not as an affected woman. I shall be pleased to welcome you."
She curtsied and went away on the Viscount's arm. At the same moment a voice at Richard's elbow drawled,
"Do I see you at the vivacious widow's feet, my good Dick?"
Carstares turned to face his brother-in-law, Colonel Belmanoir.
"Is not all London?"
he smiled.
"Oh, no, not since the beautiful Gunnings arrived. But I admit she is a dainty piece.
And Lavinia? Will she break her heart, I wonder?" He laughed beneath his breath as he saw Richard's eyes flash.
"I trust not," replied Carstares. "Are you all here tonight?" "Our illustrious head is absent, I believe. Andrew is flirting with the Fletcher girl in the blue salon. I am here, and Lavinia is amusing herself with Lovelace." "Yes, Richard, Lovelace. Be careful."
With another sneering laugh he walked on, bowing to Elizabeth Gunning, who passed by on the arm of her partner, His Grace of Hamilton, most palpably a prix. At that moment, two late-comers entered the room and made their way towards their hostess, who appeared delighted to see them, especially the taller of the two, whose hand she slapped with good-humoured raillery. The shorter gentleman wore no mask, and the colonel recognised Frank Fortescue. His eyes travelled to the other, who, unlike most of the men who only held their masks, had fastened his across his eyes, and they widened in surprise. The purple domino, worn carelessly open, revealed black satin encrusted with silver and diamonds. The natural hair was raven black. The nostrils were pinched and the lips thin.
"The devil!" ejaculated Robert, and strolled over to him.
Fortescue walked away when he saw who approached, and His Grace of Andover turned slowly towards his brother.
"I rather thought you were in Paris," yawned the colonel. "I am always sorry to disillusion you," bowed His Grace. "Not at all. I am transported with joy at seeing you, as is Lavinia, it appears."
Lady Lavinia, on recognizing His Grace, had dropped her partner's hand and fled incontinent towards him.
"You, Tracy!"
She clasped delighted hands on his arm.
"This is very touching," sneered Robert. "It only needs Andrew to complete the happy reunion. Pray excuse me." "With pleasure," replied the Duke gently, and bowed as if to a stranger. "He grows tedious," he remarked, as soon as the colonel was out of earshot.
"Oh, Bob, I take no account of him. But, Tracy, how is it you have come today? I thought—"
"My dear Lavinia, do I wear an air of mystery? I imagined you knew I was promised to Dolly Cavendish tonight."
"Yes, but—oh, what matters it? I am so charmed to see you again, dear."
"You flatter me, Lavinia."
"And now that you have come, I want to hear why you ever went. Tracy, take me into the room behind us. I know 'tis empty."
"Very well, child, as you will." He held back the curtain for her and followed her into the deserted chamber. "You want to know why I went?"
he began, seating himself at her side.
"I counsel you, my dear, to cast your mind back to the spring, at Bath."
"Your affair, of course. So the lady proved unkind?"
"No, but I bungled it."
"You? Tell me at once, at once!"
His Grace stretched out his leg and surveyed his shoe buckle through half-closed lids.
"I had arranged everything," he said, "and all would have been well, but for an interfering young jackanapes who chanced along the track and saw fit to espouse Madame Diana's cause."
He paused. "He tripped me up by some trick, and then que veux-tu?"
"Who was it?"
"How should I know? At first he seemed familiar. At all events, he knew me. He may be dead by now,
I hope he is.
Gracious! Did you wound him?
I managed to fire at him, but he was too quick, and the bullet took him in the shoulder. It may, however, have been mortal.
And so you went to Paris?
Aye, to forget her.
And have you forgotten?
I have not. She is never out of my thoughts. I plan again. His sister sighed.
She is then more beautiful than the Pompadour?
She asked meaningly. Tracy turned his head. The Pompadour?
Aye. We heard you contrived to amuse yourself in a pretty fashion, Tracy.
Really? I had no idea people were so interested in my affairs. But amuse is an apt word.
Ah? You were not then a prix?
I? Was that low-born coquette? My dear Lavinia! She laughed at his haughty tone.
You've not always been so nice, Tracy. But what of your Diana? And you are so infatuated, you had best wed her.
Why, so I think.
Lady Lavinia gasped.
Tracy, you do not mean it! Goodness me! But a marriage?
Why not, Lavinia?
Oh, a respectable man, forsooth, and how long will the passion last?
I cannot be expected to foretell that, surely. I hope for ever.
And you'll tie yourself up for the sake of one chit? Lord!
I can conceive of a worse fate for a man.
Can you? Well, tell me more. 'Tis monstrous exciting. Do you intend to court her?
At this stage of the proceedings? That was somewhat tactless, my dear. I must abduct her. But I must be more careful. Once I have her, I can propitiate Popper.
Tracy, 'tis the maddest scheme ever I heard. What will the others say?
Do you really suppose I care?
No, I suppose not. Oh, will not Bob be furious, though?
It were almost worth while just for the sake of foiling him. He would so like to succeed me, but I really do not think he must. His elbow was on his knee, his chin in his hand, and a peculiar smile on his lips. Can you imagine him stepping into my ducal shoes, Lavinia?
Very easily, she cried. Oh, yes, yes, Tracy. Marry the girl.
If she will.
Why, 'tis not like you to underrate your persuasive powers.
His Grace's thin nostrils wrinkled up in a curious grimace. I believe one cannot force a girl to the altar, he said.
Unless she is a fool, she'll have you.
Her parent would be influenced by my dukedom, but she, no. Not even if she knew it.
Does she not know?
Certainly not. I am Mr. Everard.
How wise of you, Tracy. So you've not to fear.
Fear? He snapped his fingers. I? The heavy curtain swung noiselessly aside. Richard Carstairs stood in the opening. Tracy turned his head and scrutinized him languidly. Then he put up his hand and removed his mask. Is it possible the husband scented an intrigue? It seems I am doomed to disappoint tonight. Lavinia, smarting from her morning's wrongs, laughed savagely.
More probably he mistook me for someone else, she snapped.
Richard bowed, his hand on the curtain. He had shown no surprise at seeing the Duke.
Far more probable, my dear. I thought you Lady Charwood. Pray give me leave. He was gone on the word. Tracy replaced his mask, chuckling.
Honest Dick grows cold, eh?
But what a snub, Lavinia.
Her little hand clenched.
Oh, how dare he! How dare he insult me so!
My dear sister, in all justice to him, you must admit the boot was rather on the other leg.
Oh, I know, I know. But he is so provoking, so jealous, so unreasonable.
Jealous? And why?
With an impatient twitch at her petticoat, she made answer, not looking at him.
Oh, I do not know, nor he. Take me back to the ballroom.
Certainly, my dear. He rose and led her out. I shall do myself the honour of waiting on you tomorrow.
Yes? How delightful 'twill be! come to dine, Tracy. Richard has promised to the Fortescues.
In that case, I have much pleasure in accepting your invitation. In heaven's name, who was this? Lovelace was bearing down upon them.
Lavinia, I have been seeking you everywhere. Ah, your servant, sir.
He bowed to his grace and took Lavinia's hand.
Oh, Harold, you remember Tracy?
She said nervously.
Tracy, I did not know you masked. I saw you last in Paris.
Really?
I regret I was not aware of your presence. It is a good many years since I had the honour of seeing you.
5, nodded Lovelace, and sent a smiling, amorous glance at Lavinia.
Exactly, bowed his grace. You have, I perceive, renewed your acquaintance with my sister. When they were gone, he caressed his chin thoughtfully. Lovelace and Richard is so jealous, so unreasonable. Now I do hope Lavinia will do nothing indiscreet. Yes, Frank, I was talking to myself about habit.
Fortescue, who had come up behind him, took his arm. A sign of lunacy, my dear. Jim Cavendish demands you.
Does he? May I ask why? He is in the card room. There is some bet on, I believe. In that case, I shall have to go. You had best accompany me, Frank.
Very well. You have seen Lady Lavinia. Beneath the mask, his grace's eyes narrowed.
I have seen Lavinia. Also, I have seen an old friend, Lovelace by name.
The captain with the full-bottomed wig? Your friend, you say?
Did I say so? I should correct myself. A friend of my sister's.
Indeed. Yes, I believe I have seen him in her company.
Tracy smiled enigmatically. I dare say.
And what of you, Tracy?
Well, what of me?
You told me this morning that you had at last fallen in love. Is it true? You are honestly in love.
Honestly? How do I know? I only know that I have felt this passion for 4 months, and now it is stronger than ever. It sounds like love.
Then, and she is a good woman, I hope she will consent to take you, such as you are, and make of you such as she can.
Now that is very neat, Frank. I congratulate you. Of course she will take me. As to the rest, I think not.
Darren Owens, Tracy, but in that is the tone you take with her, she'll have none of you.
I have never found it unsuccessful.
With your common trollops, no. But if your Diana is a lady, she will dispatch you about your business. Woo her, man. Forget your own damned importance, for I think you will need to humble yourself to the dust if all that you tell me has passed between you is true. They had paused outside the card-room. A curtain shut it off from the ballroom, and with his hand on it, Tracy stared arrogantly down at his friend.
Humble myself! For gad, you must be mad!
Belike I am, but I tell you, Tracy, that if your passion is love, 'tis a strange one that puts yourself first. I would not give the snap of a finger for it. You want this girl, not for her happiness, but for your own pleasure. That is not the love I once told you would save you from yourself. When it comes, you will count yourself as naught. You will realize your own insignificance, and above all, be ready to make any sacrifice for her sake. Yes, even to the point of losing her. His Grace's lips sneered.
Your eloquence is marvelous, he remarked. I have not been so amused since I left Paris.
End of chapter 19. Recording by Tara Mendoza. Phoenix, Arizona. September 2011. Chapter 20 of The Black Moth. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tara Mendoza. The Black Moth by Georgette Hare. Chapter 20. His Grace of Andover Takes a Hand in the Game. When the Duke of Andover dined next day at Grosvenor Square, he contrived, by subtle means, to make his sister feel inexplicably ill at ease. He let fall pleasant little remarks concerning her friendship with Captain Lovelace, in which she read disapproval and a sinister warning. She was afraid of him, as she was not of her husband, and she knew that if he ever guessed at the depths of her affection for the old flame, he would take very effective measures towards stopping her intercourse with him. It was then entirely owing to his return that she told Lovelace that he must not so palpably adore her, neither must he visit her so frequently. They were both in her boudoir at the time, one morning, and no doubt Lavinia looked very lovely and very tempting in her wrapper, with her golden curls free from powder, and loosely dressed beneath her escalloped lace ruffle. At all events, Lovelace abandoned his daintily bantering pose and seized her in his arms, nearly smothering her with fierce, passionate caresses. Her ladyship struggled, gave a faint shriek, and started to cry. As his kisses seemed to aggravate her tears, he picked her up, and carrying her to a chair, lowered her gently into it. Then, having first dusted the floor with his handkerchief, he knelt down beside her and possessed himself of both her hands. "Lavinia, goddess, I adore you." Bethinking herself that tears were ruinous to her complexion, Lady Lavinia pulled her hands away and dabbed at her eyes.
"Oh, Harold!"
she reproached him.
"I have offended you, wretch that I am."
"Oh, no, no."
Lady Lavinia gave him her hand again.
"But 'twas wicked of you, Harry. You must never, never do it again."
His arm crept round her waist.
"But I love you, sweetheart."
"Oh, oh, think of Dickie."
He released her at that, and sprang to his feet.
"Why should I think of him? 'Tis of you and myself, I think. Only a week ago you vowed he was unkind."
"You are monstrous wicked to remind me of that. We were both cross, and then we were both sorry. I am very fond of poor Dickie."
"Fond of him? Ay, so you may be. But you do not love him. Not as a woman loves a man, do you?"
"Harold!"
"Of course you do not. You used to love me. No, do not shake your head. 'Tis true. You would have married me had it not been for Tracy."
"Oh, Harry, how can you say so? What had he to do with it?"
"What indeed? Whose fault was it that I was time after time refused admittance at Andover? Whose fault was it that you were induced to marry Carstairs?"
"Not Tracy's. 'Twas my own wish."
"Fostered by his influence?"
"Oh, no."
"You never loved Carstairs."
"I did. I do."
"You may think so, but I know better. Why, he is not even suited to you. You were made for life and pleasure and hazard. With me you would have had all that. With him—"
She had risen to her feet and drawn nearer to him, her eyes sparkling, but now she covered her ears with her hands and stamped pettishly.
"I will not listen. I will not, I tell you. Oh, you are unkind to plague me so."
Lovelace took her into his arms once more, and drawing down her hands, kissed her again and again. She resisted, trying to thrust him off, but she was crushed against him, and he would have kissed her again had not there come an interruption. A knock fell on the door, and the footman announced,
"His Grace of Andover, milady."
The guilty pair sprang apart in the nick of time, she fiery red, he pale but composed. His Grace stood in the doorway, his quizzing glass raised inquiringly. His eyes went swiftly from one to the other and widened. He bowed elaborately.
"My dear Lavinia, Captain Lovelace, you're very obedient."
Lovelace returned the bow with much flourish.
"Your Grace."
"Dear me, Tracy," cried Lavinia, advancing. "What an unexpected visit."
"I trust I have not arrived at an inopportune moment, my dear."
"Oh, no, no," she assured him. "I am quite charmed to see you, but at such an early hour, I confess, it quite astonishes me."
She brought him to a chair, chattering like a child, and so innocent was his expression, so smiling his attitude towards the captain, that she imagined that he suspected nothing, and had not noticed her blushes. It was only when Lovelace had departed that she was undeceived. Then, when his Grace moved to a chair opposite her, she saw that he was frowning slightly.
"'You are put out over something, Tracy?"
she asked nervously. The frown deepened.
"No, I am not put out. I merely anticipate the sensation."
I do not understand. What mean you?
At present, nothing.
Tracy, please do not be mysterious. Are you like to be put out?
I trust not, Lavinia.
But what annoys you?
Instead of answering, he put a question. I hope you amused yourself well last night, my dear sister. She flushed. Last night had been Lady Davenant's masquerade, to which Lord Robert had conducted her. She had danced almost exclusively with Lovelace the whole evening, but as they were both masked, she was rather surprised at the question.
I enjoyed myself quite tolerably, thank you. You were there?
No, Lavinia, I was not there.
Then how do you know?
She stopped in confusion, biting her lips. For an instant she caught a glimpse of his eyes, piercing and cold. How do I know? Smoothly finished his grace. One hears things, Lavinia. Also, he glanced round the room. One sees things.
I do not understand you,
she shot out, twisting the lace of her gown with restless, uneasy fingers. No. Must I then be more explicit?
Yes. Yes, I should be glad.
Then let me beg of you, my dear Lavinia, that you will commit no indiscretion. Her cheeks flamed.
You mean?
I mean that you have grown too friendly with Harold Lovelace.
Well, what of it?
His Grace put up his eyeglass, faintly astonished. What of it? Pray think a moment, Lavinia.
'Tis not likely that I shall be the one to disgrace the name, Tracy.
I sincerely hope not. I give you my word I should do all in my power to prevent any foolhardy action on your part. Pray do not forget it. She sat silent, biting her lips. It is, my child, unwise to play with fire. Sooner or later one gets burnt. And remember that your gallant captain is not one half of Richard's wealth. Up she sprang, kicking her skirts as she always did when angered.
Money, money, always money, she cried. I do not care one rap for it, and Richard is not wealthy.
Richard is heir to wealth, replied His Grace calmly. And even in you are so impervious to its charms, I, my dear, am not. Richard is extremely useful to me. I beg you will not leave him for any such mad rake as Lovelace, who would be faithful to you for perhaps 3 months, certainly not longer.
Tracy, I will not have you speak to me like this. How dare you insult me so? I have given you no cause. I did not say I had any desire to run away with him, and he would be faithful to me. He has been faithful all these years.
His Grace smiled provokingly. My dear.
I know. There have been episodes. Indiscretions. Do you think I count him the worse for that?
Evidently not.
There has never been another serious love with him. I hate you.
You are overfree with your emotions, my dear. So you do indeed contemplate an elopement?
No, 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 I do not. I am fond of Dicky.
Dear me.
Of course I shall not leave him.
Why, then? I am satisfied, he answered and rose to his feet. I shall look to see Captain Lovelace more out of your company. He picked up his hat and cane and stood directly in front of her. One dead white hand on which blazed a great ruby seal ring took her little pointed chin in a firm clasp and tilted her head up until she was forced to meet his eyes. They held hers inexorably scorchingly. You understand me? He asked harshly. Lavinia's eyes filled with tears, and her soft underlip trembled.
Yes,
she fluttered, and gave a tiny sob.
Oh, yes, Tracy.
The eyes lost something of their menacing gleam, and he smiled, for once without a sneer, and releasing her chin, patted her cheek indulgently.
Bear in mind, child, that I am 15 years your senior, and I have more worldly wisdom in my little finger than you have in the whole of your composition. I do not wish to witness your ruin.
The tears brimmed over, and she caught his handkerchief from him, dabbing at her eyes with one heavily laced corner.
You do love me, Tracy?
In the recesses of my mind, I believe I cherish some affection for you, he replied coolly, rescuing his handkerchief. I used to class you with your deplorable brothers, but I think perhaps I was wrong.
She gave an hysterical laugh.
Tracy! How can you be so disagreeable?
Lud, but I pity Diana as she marries you." To her surprise, he flushed a little.
"Diana, and she marries me, will have all that her heart could desire," he answered stiffly and took his leave. Once outside in the square, he looked for a sedan, and not seeing one, walked away towards Audley Street. He went quickly, but his progress was somewhat retarded by two ladies, who, passing in their chairs down the street, perceived him and beckoned him to their sides. Escaping presently from them, he turned into Curzon Street, and from thence down Half Moon Street, where he literally fell into the arms of Tom Wilding, who had much to say on the subject of March's last bet with Edgecombe. His Grace affected interest, politely declined Wilding's proffered escort, and hurried down into Piccadilly, walking eastwards towards St. James Square, where was the Andover townhouse. He was fated to be again detained, for as he walked along Arlington Street, Mr. Walpole was on the point of descending the steps of Number 5. He also had much to say to His Grace. He had no idea Belmanoir had returned from Paris. A week ago he had arrived. Well, he, Walpole, had been out of town all the week, at Twickenham. He hoped Bell would honour him with his company at the small card party he was giving there on Thursday. George was coming, and Dick Edgecombe. He had asked March and Gilly Williams, but the Lord knew whether both would be induced to appear. Bell had heard of Gilly's absurd jealousy. Wilding was promised, and Markham's several other answers he was awaiting. Andover accepted gracefully, and parted from Walpole. He made the rest of his journey in peace, and on arriving at his house, went straight to the library, where sat a sleek, eminently respectable-looking individual, dressed like a groom. He stood up as His Grace entered and bowed. Belmanoir nodded shortly and sat down at his desk.
"I have work for you, Harper."
"Yes, sir, Your Grace,
I should say."
"Do you know Sussex?"
"Well, Your Grace, I don't know as how—" "Do you know Sussex?"
"No, Your Grace. Yes, Your Grace. I should say not well, Your Grace."
"Have you heard of a place called Little Dean?"
"No, sir. Your Grace."
"Midhurst?"
"Oh, yes, Your Grace."
"Good. Little Dean is 7 miles west of it. You will find that out. Also an inn called, I think, the Pointing Finger. There you will lodge."
"Yes, Your Grace, certainly."
"At a very little distance from there is a house, Horton House, where lives a certain Mr. Beauleigh, with his sister and daughter. You are to watch the comings and goings of these people with the utmost care. Eventually you will become groom to Mr. Beauleigh."
But Your Grace," feebly protested the astonished Harper.
"You will approach their present groom, and you will insinuate that I, Andover, am in need of a second groom. You will tell them that I pay handsomely, treble what Mr. Beauleigh gives him. If I know human nature, he will apply for the post. You then step in. If Mr. Beauleigh asks for some recommendation, you are to refer him to Sir Hugh Grandison, White's Chocolate House, St. James Street. When you are engaged, I will send further instructions." The man gaped, shut his mouth, and gaped again. "Do you fully understand me?" asked Belmanoir calmly.
Yes, Your Grace."
"Repeat what I have said, then." Harper stumbled through it and mopped his brow unhappily. "Very well. In addition, I pay you twice as much as Mr. Beauleigh gives you, and at the end, if you serve me well, 50 guineas. Are you satisfied?"
Harper brightened considerably. "Yes, Your Grace. Thank you, sir."
Tracy laid 20 guineas before him. "That is for your expenses. Remember this. The sooner the thing is done, the more certain are your 50 guineas. That is all. Have you any questions to ask?"
Harper cudgelled his still dazed brain, and finding none, shook his head.
"No, Your Grace." "Then you may go." The man bowed himself out, clutching his guineas. He was comparatively a newcomer in His Grace's service, and he was by no means accustomed to the Duke's lightning method of conducting his affairs. He was not sure that he quite appreciated it, but 50 guineas were 50 guineas.
End of Chapter 20. Recording by Tara Mendoza. Phoenix, Arizona, September 2011. Chapter 21 of The Black Moth. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tara Mendoza. The Black Moth by Georgette Hare. Chapter 21. Mrs. Fanshawe lights a fire, and O'Hara fans the flame. Richard Carstairs very soon availed himself of Mrs. Fanshawe's permission to call upon her, and duly put in an appearance at No. 16 Mount Street. He found the house very tastefully appointed, the sister elderly and good-natured, and the widow herself an excellent hostess. The first time he called, he was not the only visitor. Two ladies whom he did not know and a young cousin were already there, and later, a bowing acquaintance, Mr. Standish, who also arrived. Seeing that he would have no opportunity to talk with the widow on the subject of his brother, he very soon took his leave, promising to wait upon her again at no very distant date. When 3 days later he again sent in his name and was admitted, he found the lady alone, and was gratified to hear her order the servant to deny her to all other visitors. He bowed over her hand and hoped she was well. Mrs. Fanshawe drew him down beside her on the settee. "I am very well, Mr. Carstairs, and you?"
"Also," he smiled, but his looks belied his words. She told him so, laughing, and he pleaded a worried week.
"Well, sir, I presume you did not come to talk to me about your health, but about your friend, eh?"
"I assure—"
"Remember, no vapid compliments," she besought. "Then, madam—"
"Yes, I want to hear about Ferndale.
You see, I, like you, took a great interest in him." She sent him a shrewd glance and nodded. "Of course, I will tell you all I know, Mr. Carstairs, but it is not very much, and maybe you will be disappointed. But I only knew him the short time we were both in Vienna, and he was not very communicative."
"Ah, he did not confide in you, madam?"
"No. If one attempted to draw his confidence, he became a polite iceberg."
"Nevertheless, madam, please tell me all that you know."
"It will not take long, I fear. I met him in 48, at Vienna, in the Prater, where I was walking with my husband, who had come to Vienna for his health. I chanced to let fall my reticule when Sir Anthony was passing us, and he picked it up, speaking the most execrable German." She smiled a little at the remembrance. "Mr. Fanshawe, who had the greatest dislike for all foreigners, was overjoyed to hear the English accent. He induced Sir Anthony to continue his walk with us, and afterwards he called at our lodgings. I think he, too, was glad to meet fellow countrymen, for he came often, and once when I had been talking with him for some time he let fall, what shall I say, his reserve, his guard, and told me that he had scarcely spoken his own language for 4 years. Afterwards he seemed to regret having said even that much, and turned the subject." She paused and looked up to see if her auditor was listening.
"Yes, yes," urged Richard. "And then?"
"I do not remember. He came, as I said, often, mostly to talk to my husband, who was a great invalid, but sometimes to see me. He would hardly ever speak of England. I think he did not trust himself. He never mentioned any relations, or any English friends, and when I spoke of home, he would shut his mouth very tightly, and look terribly sad. I saw that for some reason the subject pained him, so I never spoke of it if I could help it. He was a most entertaining companion, Mr. Carstairs. He used to tell my husband tales that made him laugh, as I had not heard him laugh for months. He was very lively, very witty, and almost finickingly well-dressed, but what his occupation was I could not quite ascertain. He said he was a gentleman of leisure, but I do not think he was at all wealthy. He frequented all the gaming-houses, and I heard tales of his marvellous luck. So one day I taxed him with it, and he laughed and said he lived by chance. He meant dice. Yet I know, for I once had a conversation with his servant, that his purse was at times very, very slender."
"The time he aided you, Mrs. Fanshawe? When was that?"
She flushed. "That was a few months after we first met him. I was foolish. My married life was not very happy, and I was, or rather I fancied myself in love, with an Austrian nobleman who—well, sir, suffice it that I consented to dine with him one evening.
I found then that he was not the gallant homme I had thought him, but something quite different. I do not know what I should have done had not Sir Anthony arrived.
He did arrive, then?
Yes. You see, he knew that this Austrian had asked me to dine. I told him, and he counselled me to refuse. But I—well, sir, I have told you, I was very young and very foolish. I would not listen. When he called at our house and found that I was out, he at once guessed where I had gone, and he followed me to the Count's house, gave an Austrian name, and was announced, just as the Count tried to kiss me. I think I shall never forget the relief of that moment. He was so safe and so English. The Count was furious, and at first I thought he would have his lackey throw Anthony out. But when he heard all that Anthony had to say, he realized that it was useless to try to detain me, and I was taken home. Anthony was very kind. He did not scold, neither had he told my husband. 2 days after, he and the Count fought a duel, and the Count was wounded in the lung. That was all. But it made me very grateful to him, and interested in his affairs. Mr. Fanshawe left Vienna a few weeks after that, and I have never seen my preux chevalier since. She sighed and looked steadily across at Carstairs. And you are so like him.
You think so, madam, was all he could find to say.
I do, sir, and something more, which perhaps you will deem an impertinence. Is Anthony your brother?
The suddenness of the attack threw Carstairs off his guard. He went white.
Madam!
Please, be not afraid that mine is the proverbial woman's tongue, sir. It does not run away with me, I assure you. When I saw you the other night for the first time, I was struck by the resemblance, and I asked my partner, Mr. Stapley, who you were. He told me, and much more beside, which I was not at the time desirous of hearing.
"Trust Will Stapley!" exclaimed Richard,
and mentally cursed the amiable gossip-monger.
"Among other things he told me of your elder brother, who, in fact, he told me the whole story. Of course my mind instantly leapt to my poor Sir Anthony, despite that in appearance he is younger than you. Was I right?"
Richard rose to his feet and walked away to the window, standing with his back to her.
"I was sure of it," she nodded. "So that was why he would not speak of England. Poor boy!"
Richard's soul writhed under the lash of her pity.
"So he will always be outcast," she continued, "alone, unhappy, without friends."
"No," he cried, turning. "For God, no, madam."
"Will society, cruel, hard society, receive him then?" she asked.
"Society will, one day, receive him, Mrs. Fanshawe. You will see."
"I long for that day," she sighed. "I wish I had it in my power to help him, to repay in part the debt I owe him."
At that he lifted his head.
"My brother, madam, would count it not a debt, but an honour," he answered proudly.
"Yes," she smiled, "you are like him. When you speak like that, you might almost be he."
"He is worth a thousand of me, Mrs. Fanshawe," he replied vehemently, and broke off, staring down at the table.
"And his name?"
she asked softly.
"John Anthony St. Irvine Delaney Carstairs," he said, "Earl of Wyncham."
So the Anthony was real. I am so glad, for he would always be Anthony to me.
There was a long silence, broken at last by the lady.
"I fear I have made you sad, Mr. Carstairs. You will drink a dish of Bohea with me, before you go, and we will not speak of this again."
"You are very good, madam, believe me. I am grateful to you for telling me all that you have. I beg you will allow me to wait on you again ere long."
"I shall be honoured, sir. I am nearly always at home to my friends."
Her sister entered the room soon after, and private conversation came to an end. Carstairs lay awake long that night, hearing the hours toll by and the owls screech in the square. The widow's words had sunk deep into his ever-uneasy conscience, and he could not sleep for the thought of John.
Alone, unhappy, without friends.
Time after time had he argued this question with himself. John
or Lavinia. He fell to wondering where his brother now was, whether he was still roaming the South Country, a highwayman. No one would ever know how he, Richard, dreaded each fresh capture made by the military. Every time he expected John to be among the prisoners, and he visited Newgate so often that his friends twitted him on it, vowing he had Selwyn's love of horrors. He would argue that the matter rested in John's own hands. If he were minded to come back to society, he would do so, but deep within himself he knew that such a decision was unworthy of one even so debased as was he. Then his mind went to Lavinia, who alternately enchanted and exasperated him. Only a week ago she had defied him openly in the matter of her friendship with Lovelace, yet had she not afterwards apologized and thrust the captain aside for his sake. She was so sweetly naughty, so childishly unreasonable. Selfish? Yes. He supposed so, but he loved her so greatly that it were a pleasure to him to die for her sake. Yet John was his brother, the adored elder brother, and by obeying Lavinia he was wronging him, hurting him. If only Lavinia would consent to the truth being told, it always came back to that point. If only she would consent, and she never would. She insisted that having married her under false pretenses, he had no right to disgrace her now. She was right, he knew, but he wished she could be for once unselfish. So he worried on through the night, tossing to and fro in his great bed, a weight on his mind, a ceaseless ache in his heart. Towards dawn he fell asleep, and did not wake again until his chocolate was brought to him. Bitterly he reflected that at least John had no conscience to prey upon him. He did not fall asleep with his brain seething with conflicting arguments, and awake with the decision as far off as ever. Today his head ached unbearably, and he stayed in bed for some time, contemplating the grey morning. A fog hung over the square, and through it the trees, with their withered autumn leaves, loomed dismally before the windows. There was something infinitely depressing about the dull outlook, and presently he rose and allowed his valet to dress him, not able to stand the inaction any longer. His headache was better by the time he had visited his wife in her room and listened to her enthusiastic account of last night's rout, and going out into the square, he called a chair, ordering the men to carry him to White's, where he intended to write two letters. Somehow, Wyncham House was too poignantly full of memories of John today, and he was thankful to be out of it. White's was crowded even at that hour of the morning, and the noise seemed to cut through his head. Men hailed him from all sides, offering him bets. Someone tried to tell him some piece of scandal. They would not let him alone, and at last his jagged nerves would no longer support it, and he left the house to go further down the street to his other club, the Cocoa Tree, which he hoped to find less rowdy. It was fuller than he expected, but many of the men had come as he had, to write letters and to be quiet. Very little gaming was as yet in swing. Richard wrote steadily for perhaps an hour, and sealed his last letter preparatory to leaving. As he affixed the wafer, he was conscious of a stir behind him, and heard exclamations of, "Where in thunder did you spring from? Gad, 'tis an age since I've seen you! Lord, 'tis O'Hara!" Then came the soft Irish voice in answer, and he slewed round in his chair to face them all. Miles O'Hara was the centre of a little group of interested and welcoming clubmen explaining his arrival. "Sure, I was in town on the matter of business, and I thought I must come to see the club to see ye all while I was here, for 'tis not often I get the chance." Richard rose, gathering up his letters, and stared across at this man who had been Jack's greatest friend. He took a step towards him. As he did so, O'Hara turned and caught sight of him. Richard was about to hail him when he suddenly noticed the change in his expression. The good humour died out of the Irishman's eyes, and left them hard and scornful. His pleasant mouth curved into a disdainful line. Carstairs still stood, one hand on the back of a chair, his eyes riveted to O'Hara's face, reading all the reproach, the red-hot anger that Miles was trying to convey to him. O'Hara achieved a sneer, and turned his shoulder, continuing to address his friends. Richard's head swam. O'Hara was ignoring him, would not speak to him. O'Hara knew the truth. He walked blindly to the door and groped for the handle. O'Hara knew. He was in the passage, on the front steps, in the road, shuddering. O'Hara knew, and he had looked at him as if—as if— Again he shuddered, and seeing an empty chair, hailed it, bidding the men carry him to Grosvenor Square. O'Hara despised him, reproached him. Then Jack was in trouble. He had seen him and learnt the truth. God, but his brain was reeling. End of chapter 21. Recording by Tara Mendoza. Phoenix, Arizona, September 2011.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get the long-lasting power you need with Energizer. Menards has the largest in-stock selection of Energizer batteries. They provide solid power for flashlights, remotes, and so much more. Right now, save big on Energizer batteries. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.